ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2018-757, the State of Ohio versus James D. Worley. For the appellant, we have Mr. Avellano.
Good morning. Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court and the Chief Justice, Andrew Avellano, on behalf of appellant James Worley, I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start today's argument citing the court's decision in State versus Lang, which is a 2011 case. The court said that due process means that a jury is capable and willing to decide a case solely based on the evidence before it, and that a trial judge must be ever watchful and prevent prejudicial occurrences, and then to determine if that happens, what the effect of such occurrences have on the jury. James Worley received neither of these in this case. First, I'm going to discuss the jury and the prejudicial information that poisoned the jury pool. Then I'll go into the other acts evidence that was unfairly prejudicial to Worley's right to a fair trial, and how in combination these two with this crime and this seated jury created reversible error. The people called to the jury in this case were part of a small community. They knew Sierra and her family. They helped search for her. They knew Mr. Worley, and many of them had already made up their minds and said that out loud in front of the rest of the jurors. They said that he was guilty. The jurors that were left after the dismissal of the other jurors for cause were and had sat through and listened to all this information from their friends and from their neighbors describing how they knew that Worley was guilty. Then also heard about people participating in organizing events for her and for her surviving family. Sierra's boyfriend was seated amongst those jurors during jury selection until he was asked to leave. So immediately after the court asks the jury pool whether or not they can be fair and impartial, or if they have any biases in favor of the prosecution or in favor of the defense, multiple jurors speak up, and their answers, their statements, and their accusations were heard again before the entire jury pool, and then ultimately before everyone who sat in judgment on the jury. Jurors number 18, 65, 80, 99, and 126 all said either that they thought he was guilty or that they had made up their minds, which made it pretty clear that they thought he was guilty. Juror number 4 added that he did this 30 years ago, and then the judge cut him off. So then finally, juror number 102 was a correctional officer at the local jail who said, yeah, I had to quit that job because everybody in there is guilty. And that was the same jail that Mr. Worley was being held pre-trial. So the jurors who sat on juries or on Worley's jury heard what their community members had to say. So imagine being the member that's left sitting on that jury with that crime. And after hearing so many of your neighbors and friends express that they were so confident that Worley was guilty, and that those people couldn't sit on the jury, you're left sitting on this jury. This is a small community, and it was inflamed. So with that, they were unable to decide Worley's fate just based on the evidence before it. They were unfairly prejudiced by hearing their neighbors and their friends' opinions. And then on top of this, they hear other acts evidence that was ripe to be interpreted in a way that the law prohibits, namely that he had a propensity to act in this way to commit this type of crime. So again, after hearing this, the jury couldn't come back with a verdict other than guilt or a recommendation of death.
Counsel, what do you base that on other than your own speculation?
Chief Justice, which part?
I could say all of it, but let's start with your fact that you say that the jury pool was tainted or poisoned, and the jurors that were ultimately selected were incapable of rendering or carrying out their oath, their oath being fair, impartial, and listening to all the evidence.
Because they're, again, close-knit community and friends, neighbors, they all sort of knew each other. And when that impact is different than hearing a stranger, perhaps in a jury pool of a big city, saying, I saw it on the news. I read it in the paper. I can't be fair.
Were these jurors questioned on whether or not they could carry out their duty as jurors?
Yes.
And did they answer affirmatively?
They did.
And you don't take them as their word then?
I think in this case, in a death penalty case, that it is too risky to assume that there was not an unfair prejudicial impact when you have so many of the prospective jurors who wound up not sitting saying that they think he's guilty
demonstrate that the jury selection process works, where those that did have a preconceived idea were weeded out, and those remaining assured the court, assured the defendant and the state that they could fulfill their responsibilities.
Under ordinary circumstances, I would agree with that. But in this situation, the statements were so outrageous and so damning of the defendant that I don't believe that in this circumstance, in this small, tight-knit community, that we can assume that the remaining jurors were not unfairly prejudiced against the defendant.
Well, who has the burden to show that they were?
The defense does.
Okay. And you're saying we're going to assume it. We're not going to, based on what evidence? That's what I'm trying to ask you to
articulate. The evidence is the statements from the jurors who were excluded.
The statements are one thing. What evidence do you have that the jurors that remained on the jury, in the jury box, were tainted, other than your assumption?
It is a reasonable inference, I believe. It's a reasonable inference that they were prejudiced based on these other statements from their community members.
Okay, proceed.
Thank you. So moving on to evidence rule 404B, it obviously prohibits the introduction of other acts to show that the defendant acted in conformity with the charged crime. As the court is aware, there are a number of reasons that other acts evidence can be admitted. In this case, the issue in controversy was identity. So the judge first asks, is the evidence relevant? Was the prior conviction from 26 years ago relevant for the particular purpose that it's offered, which is identity? Then the court needs to consider whether, if the evidence is relevant to that issue, then the court considers whether or not the value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And this is very important because almost always other acts evidence, as the court has stated in Hartman, I believe, almost always other acts evidence carries some risk that the jury will draw the forbidden propensity inference. So in this case, by the end of the trial, after the jury heard Worley's admissions and the DNA evidence, identity really wasn't an issue. It wasn't really in dispute at that point. So the question becomes, if the evidence is only slightly probative of a non-propensity theory on the part of the state, but it's highly likely to be unfairly prejudicial, then the evidence must be excluded.
Well, counselor, whose job is it to weigh how much propensity the other act's evidence is. Isn't that the trial court, and that's reviewed for abuse of discretion?
It is the trial court's job to make that judgment, yes.
So in this case, you've got a woman whose bicycle was bumped by a truck, was put into a truck, hit on the head. I mean, why isn't this enough of a particular modus operandi to be probative of the fact that this is how this person operates in committing this particular type of crime when abducting a young woman?
Yes. The issue of modus operandi, I guess we're looking for, is this a distinctive one-of-a-kind type of behavior? Is it a signature method of working? And here there's enough difference between the 1990 conviction and the charged crimes here to be excluded.
Well, the difference is, in the first instance, the person got away. That's the larger difference, as opposed to the victim in this case.
That would be correct. That would be a correct observation. But again, we're going back to, what is the purpose that the evidence is being introduced for? What is the relevance of the evidence? And if the only disputed issue is the identity of who the abductor was. Again, by the end of the trial, and remember, Ms. Gardner was the last witness on the last day of trial. So I think it was the beginning of that last day, she's it. And she testifies about how she was abducted by the defendant. So at that point, we already know that Worley has made several admissions to being in the area, that DNA links his presence at the abduction site. It's really
But Counselor, all of that still, and there was never an admission that he was the perpetrator. I mean, even though the state had evidence, physical evidence tying him to the crime, his continued position was, I didn't do this. This is not me. I'm not guilty.
Agreed. And I think that's where the role of the judge becomes so critical, that the judge has to weigh what does the state have as proof of identity? And that evidence was pretty overwhelming. So what is the value added to proving identity versus unfair prejudice to the defendant?
Well, and what's the unfair prejudice here?
I mean,
you just said that the state had a significant amount of evidence that linked your client to being the perpetrator. Undeniable, undisputable, indisputable evidence, DNA, et cetera. He had, friends' testimony against him. He had, a very solid case against him. Where's the prejudice?
The prejudice is the human nature to assume that he acted in conformity with what he did 26 years earlier. That this is a guy who abducts women by the roadside.
Okay, and so the pattern, when you say a signature, it wasn't a signature type of activity. He hits, hit somebody in the back of the head, held a screwdriver to her throat, and that same occurrence, using a screwdriver, because there were screwdriver that was, found in relationship to the murder that he was on trial for. So the things that were in common, in concert with the first crime, were present in the second crime.
Well, Chief Justice, actually, in the first crime, the conviction was for using his truck to nudge a bicycle off the road. And then he used a screwdriver to hold the victim at bay to then try to handcuff her.
And Counselor, wasn't the nudge on a road near a cornfield?
Yes, it was. Similar to this case? Okay. And in this community, this is a rural community. So abductions by the roadside probably are going to be by some field of produce. But back to the Chief Justice's point, in the charged crime, there was a hairline fracture in the back of the skull in the first, in the 1990 abduction. I do not believe there's any evidence that he struck her in the back of the head. In the charged crime, there was no evidence presented that a screwdriver was used to hold the victim at bay. There was—
But a screwdriver was found, correct?
Screwdriver was found in the presence of automotive fuses and some other items from the defendant's motorcycle. So they're really, you know, again, the screwdriver, there's no evidence that he used the screwdriver to hold the victim in this case at bay. So I think there is significant difference between the two events. But again, going back to it, I think that proves the point that this is a guy who uses a screwdriver to hold his victims at bay by the roadside. But the ultimate issue, the ultimate question is the identity of the perpetrator in this case, not the 1990 case. That's the unfair prejudice. That when you allow the 1990 case in, it unfairly prejudices the jury to believe that he acted in conformity with.
Mr. Avellano, are you also concerned, since you argued cumulative effect of error, that the juror who was dismissed earlier statement that I know he did this 20 years ago, plus this evidence of other acts, cumulatively creates a problem?
Yes, very much so. Because we have this crime, which is of a disturbing nature, and we have the jury who heard from one of their friends and neighbors, this guy did this 30 years ago. So we have a tainted jury and evidence.
So let me follow up just very quickly. This is Fulton County. This is pretty rural. And it looked to me like the veneer panel that there were over 200 jurors called from a fairly not populated county. And it looked like the judge made a lot of efforts to understand the population and also to caution them daily. How could the judge have changed that? Because it seemed like the judge was being very careful.
I think this was the first death penalty case for this judge. I think what he could have done is he could have used individual voir dire more thoroughly. That there was a number of jurors who said, you know, this was the biggest thing to happen in Fulton County in a long time. And people were watching the TV, they were reading the papers, they were on Facebook with all their friends in the community.
Okay. So where did they pull 200 people together in the courthouse? Did they have to go to a gymnasium, or I mean, did they do 200 at a time?
I believe that the courtroom was large enough. They had two groups of jurors so the first group of potential jurors were all in the courtroom. And that's where the majority of these damaging statements were made, in the presence and hearing of these of the jurors who ultimately sat in judgment of Mr. Worley.
So there were two groups, but the second group didn't hear what the first group heard in terms of other jurors' comments, correct?
Correct. But no one in that second group sat on the jury.
All right, thank you.
Counsel, is it appellant's position then that in a rural county in a death penalty case, every potential juror must be individually questioned, even if you have to go through 300 or 400 people? Is that perhaps your position?
Perhaps. I mean, this is how do I distinguish
between, you know, Warren County, Ohio, and Fulton County?
Was the question, how do we distinguish?
Well, where do you draw the line? What counties have to have everyone asked every question individually?
It would be up to the judge to determine based on, you know, the answers of the jury in the general voir dire. Now, juror number four was one of the first people questioned in front of everyone, and he was the one who said, I believe it may have been a she, that you know, this happened 30 years ago. I can't be fair and impartial. At that point, defense counsel moved to sidebar and requested that this group of petit jurors be replaced. And there were plenty of other jurors to bring in. And again, this is the judge's first death penalty trial. Perhaps he could have been more stern with the jurors to indicate, I don't want to hear anything about what you read on Facebook. I don't want to hear anything about what you know about this defendant or about the alleged victim. I just want to know if you can be fair and impartial. And if you can't, raise your hand and we'll go to a sidebar and we'll discuss it in private.
Did the judge issue any curative instructions?
He did. But, you know, these were whoppers. These were so big that, you know, don't think of that pink elephant. They're not amenable to a curative instruction.
Counsel, was there an attempt to change the venue of this trial?
I don't believe there was.
I mean, I didn't find it. I'm just wondering.
You caught me in a moment of thought. I don't believe that there was a motion for change of venue.
Okay, so presumably the defendant was okay with trying this in this county.
Well, I don't know that, Chief Justice. It may have been that his attorneys felt that they were comfortable trying it in this county. Back to Justice Fisher's point, we're not saying that you can never have a death penalty case in a small rural county. We have to look at what happened. How was the jury managed? How was the voir dire managed? What precautions were taken to prevent these types of damning statements from being uttered?
Did the record reflect that this was the judge's first death penalty trial?
Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, and he was very clear. He's like, you know, this is my first rodeo. I'm open to suggestions. You know, let's try to get this right.
But one follow-up question. I mean, a person's entitled to be judged by a jury of their peers. So one of the nuances that you're going to have in a rural community like this is that people may be more tuned into what's going on. And I mean, no one asked for it to be moved to another county. I mean, isn't there a benefit to him to be tried in the county where people have sort of the same mannerisms and thoughts, especially in terms of judging credibility and the evidence?
Absolutely. It could have. It absolutely could have. But not in this case. You know, the jurors who were removed for cause or through peremptories, you know, had expressed, you know, that they had made up their minds, or they knew the defendant, or they knew someone. One of the jurors said, yeah, you know, I know this guy who knows the defendant, and no way can I be fair and impartial, you know, intimating that this guy, you know, is a jerk or what have you, and I don't trust him. So it really could cut both ways. And in this instance, it cut against a fair and impartial jury. So just to sum up the 404B situation, we have Robin Gardner, the victim of the 1990 abduction. She's the last witness in this case, and she was a member of this community, a member of the community that had been traumatized. And one of the people that the other jurors would have known. So she was one of them. And she's coming forward to say, this man abducted me. What is the jury supposed to take from that? Again, ultimately the issue is identity. And there was more than enough evidence for the jury to determine that Mr. Worley was the one involved in her abduction. And so to admit this evidence, the weighing was pretty straightforward.
Did the parties stipulate to the existence of Worley's prior conviction?
They stipulated to the prior conviction of having for the purposes of having a weapon under disability, yes. And for the marijuana conviction, but there was a written motion to exclude the 1990 conviction, and that motion was renewed at the time, the morning of the testimony of Ms. Gardner. So in closing, I'd like to say that the voir dire in this case makes it clear that this, again, was a small community with strong bonds, strong feelings, and that this had happened to one of their own. And that with the facts of this case and with this tainted jury, there was no way that James Worley could get a fair trial. I also like to cite the case of Shepard versus Maxwell. It was a 1966 Supreme Court case where the court said, with his life at stake, it's not requiring too much that the petitioner be tried in an atmosphere undisturbed by a wave of public passion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Avellano, you've used 28 minutes of your time. I'm presuming that Mr. Grimm is not going to argue at this point?
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I may, Your Honor, in looking at the video screen, I thought I actually had more time left than 2 minutes.
All right. You have 2 minutes and 51 seconds. Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
We'll move on now to Mr. Hasselman.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Associate Justices. My name is Scott Hazelman. I'm the Fulton County Prosecuting Attorney today here on behalf of the state of Ohio. I'd like to talk a little bit about the jury selection. As Mr. Avellano pointed out, Fulton County is comparatively a small county compared to Franklin County, Cuyahoga County, roughly 43,000 people. But I think there is sometimes a misbelief that everyone in a small county literally knows every other person in a county. But recognizing that this is a small county, the judge planned to call 400 people as an initial jury pool, because the goal of the court was to get 50 qualified jurors, death penalty qualified, free of any bias, able to sit, pass for cause. So the judge pulls 400 names. They sent out the initial questionnaire to get rid of those jurors who cannot sit for purposes of medical reasons. They move out of the county. They may have died, things of those nature. You get down to 224 jurors to be called for general voir dire. They are broken into two groups. Roughly half come the first day for general voir dire, half roughly the second day. The two statements that were raised in the appellant's brief as being made by members of the potential panel who did not sit on the ultimate jury were made in front of different halves of the panel. At the end of the general voir dire, roughly 107 jurors made it to what I'm gonna call the individual voir dire process, which was to focus on pretrial publicity, things they may have heard about the case, and death penalty. And I was involved in trying this case. And while it was long and tedious, actually getting a jury in this case was relatively easy. It only took 81 jurors at the individual voir dire process to get to the 50 that had been sought. 26 jurors were not even questioned and were sent home. Now, with respect to the question of whether the trial court abused its discretion in overruling defendant's motion to dismiss the entire panel, the record shows that he did not abuse his discretion. The judge, because it was his first death penalty trial, was more than conscientious in trying to ensure that a fair trial was obtained. Prior to ultimately denying the motion to dismiss the panel, the judge indicated that he had re-listened to the statements or read the transcript. After the statement was made, the judge immediately, after we came back from chambers, gave an instruction to the jurors that everything that they hear outside the evidence that would be obtained in the courtroom is not to be considered by them. He properly instructed the jury. And in overruling the motion, the judge recognized that the jury was going to hear some level about the defendant's past, because there had been a stipulation that was going to be read to the jury that both Mr. Worley had been convicted of a felony offense of violence and a felony offense, drug offense, because those were elements of his, the charge of having weapons under disability. In fact, after the second statement, in front of the second panel, the judge actually, after instructing the jury, pulled them immediately and says, anybody here who can't be fair based upon those statements? And the judge indicated that he was completely satisfied that the jury panel left at that moment when he denied the motion had not been affected by those statements. He's not even sure everyone who was a potential juror even heard the statement of juror number four. That's what he said. And in fact, indicated that importantly, all of these people who get selected past the general voir dire stage are gonna be subject to individual voir dire and can be asked about their position on this case, which is exactly what happened. And I think that is really the crux of the issue, because in the individual voir dire process, the court would ask questions, counsel would ask questions, as one would expect. And at the end of the court's inquiry, and I think it's important to recognize that counsel and the trial court are there. They don't have just the words on a page. They hear the potential juror. They understand the body language. They hear the tone. And I think at the end of almost every juror, I believe the judge would ask something to the effect, nothing that they'd previously heard about the case would impact their ability to render a fair verdict, and that they would decide the case based solely on the evidence that was presented in the courtroom. And all of those jurors indicated that they would. There was not every juror who actually decided Mr. Worley's case indicated that they did not have an opinion about his guilt. There's nothing that they'd previously heard about the case would impact on their ability to render a fair verdict, and that they would decide the case based solely on the evidence presented in the courtroom. And I think that is underscored by the fact that of the 12 jurors who decided the case, 11 of them were passed on for cause by both parties. And juror number 40, who was the juror who was a challenge for cause by the defense, it's clear that that was completely unrelated to anything having to do with what that juror may have heard. That challenge was clearly related to the fact that juror number 40 did not have a complete understanding, as many people who are not lawyers don't, what a mitigating circumstance may be, what is that compared to what is an affirmative defense such as self-defense. So at the conclusion of individual voir dire, in that panel of 50 jurors, 46 of them had been passed on for cause by both parties. I believe two of the potential jurors had been challenged for cause based upon pretrial publicity. One was juror number 40, who appears to be related to death penalty related issues. And one of the jurors, I believe it was 137, who was challenged for cause Actually, they had originally passed for cause, and then there was a later challenge for cause because I believe there was some just confusion as to whether that juror had potentially been challenged. So I think that the evidence clearly establishes that there was a fair and impartial jury who heard this case. The state would submit that under the state this court's decision in Adams, right, this court will not presume that an improper comment made by a potential juror will somehow bias the entire jury panel, and that the burden is on the defendant to establish that the jury was either unlawfully impaneled or that it could not be fair and impartial. And I think respectfully that the appellant cannot make such a showing in this particular case. With respect to the 404B evidence, when you go to address the question of how much evidence is enough evidence, I would simply direct the court to Mr. Worley's trial defense counsel's closing argument, because I reviewed that in preparation for today's hearing. And if you look at that, which at various points, defense counsel argued James Worley did not come into contact with Sierra Joggin that night. James Worley wasn't there. He didn't do this crime. He didn't do this. Mr. Worley was not involved. It didn't happen the way the state says it did. He was not involved in this. So the question is not that the issue of identity was not at issue. It clearly was at issue. It was a main factor of the defense. And while I believe that the state's case was overwhelming on many fronts, very interlocked issues to establish his guilt, the 404B evidence goes to the heart of the issue in this case, which is the identity of the person who kidnapped and murdered Sierra Joggin. The appellant referred to the Hartman case, and there are significant differences factually between Hartman and this case. In Hartman, it was a acquaintance rape case. The question wasn't who, it was what happened. In this case, there's no doubt as to what happened. Sierra was kidnapped and murdered. The question is who committed the crime. And before Ms. Gardner testified, the judge gave an instruction. I acknowledge the defense did object to the testimony, but once the judge was going to admit the testimony, the party stipulated as to how the jury should be instructed on the use of the evidence that was going to be presented. And then in the jury instructions, I believe that the trial court read verbatim the other acts instruction that had been requested by the defense in their December 8, 2017 filing, which was document 243. So then we get to the question of, does the 1990 incident involving Robin Gardner, who was not a Fulton County resident in 1990, let's be clear, that was a Lucas County incident. She lived over across the line in Lucas County and is not a Fulton County resident today. She resides in a different state. You have, if you compare the issues, you have two young women in 1990, Robin Gardner was 26, riding their bicycles on rural roads. They are knocked off their bicycle and both hit in the head. There was evidence, the question was asked if there was evidence that she had, Mrs. Gardner had been hit in the head, and there was. She testified that she had actually been hit in the head, on the back of the head, resulting in a mild skull fracture and a concussion. The evidence being in this case that Sierra Joggin had been hit in the head with Mr. Worley's motorcycle helmet. You have, these are daytime attacks, and I think the most idiosyncratic nature of the similarities are the use of the screwdriver. Ms. Gardner's testimony at trial was that Mr. Worley held the screwdriver to her throat in order to try to require obtain control over her, he then took her to his pickup truck where he had handcuffs. He had got one handcuffed on her arm. They were struggling when another vehicle pulls up, and she's able to flag that vehicle down and to be whisked away from the scene. In this case, Mr. Worley, when he met with police, acknowledged that he lost on his motorcycle ride four items. automotive fuses, his sunglasses, his helmet, and a screwdriver. Now, the abduction scene was up on County Road 6 near Ms. Joggins' home. In the eastern side, there's cornfields on both sides of the road. In the eastern cornfield is where Mr. Worley hid his motorcycle out of sight. And near that motorcycle was found automotive fuses. On the western side of the cornfield, western side of the road in the western cornfield, where there were signs of struggle, corn knocked down, apparent blood found on the corn, DNA matches Miss Joggin, her bicycles found in the corn, Mr. Worley's sunglasses are found in the vicinity on the, near the western side of the road. His motorcycle helmet was picked up by a passing vehicle that evening and before being brought back. But it was in the western cornfield where Sierra was struggling with her assailant that the screwdriver was found. It wasn't over by his motorcycle and where he dropped his fuses. It was where the struggle occurred. Additionally, Ms. Joggin is found handcuffed, right? Ms. Gardner had been handcuffed. At the time her body is found, Sierra was handcuffed. And the handcuff has on it a bread tie, was a key, a very unique key, with a similar unique key being found on Mr. Worley's key ring when he was taken to jail. The officer who found, the investigating officer saying that he's, I believe, a 24-year veteran. It was a very unique key. He had never seen such a key in his career. There was also evidence that Mr. Worley had, for lack of a better term, kidnapping kits in his other vehicles. He had pre-looped zip ties under the floor mat of his green pickup truck. He had pre-looped zip ties in the passenger pocket of his red pickup truck behind the seat within easy access. In his various trucks, he had ski masks, pepper spray. Ms. Joggin had been found tied with rope. Rope were found in these trucks, duct taped. At his residence, handcuffs were found in one of his tool chests. Respectfully, the MO in this case is, it follows along. It's very idiosyncratic. And in this case, it's not that the jury was asked or that they did use the defendant's character to show that he acted in conformance with that character. It's rather the characteristics of the specific facts.
Mr. Hesselman, as yes. Mr. Avellano stated earlier, this is a rural area. So if someone's going to be abducted, it's likely to be when there's high grass or corn, or I'm assuming a lot of the residents in the area have pickup trucks or some sort of a truck vehicle. And I did ask him about this obviously earlier, but in retrospect, what makes someone abducted from the side of a road near in an area where there are a lot of cornfields in a truck so unique?
Well, I think in this particular case, the fact that it is a rural area, I think is relevant, because obviously a person who's going to act to commit a crime is going to do it in an area where they are not likely to be found. That's part of the planning of that type of event.
But wouldn't that be a plan for probably a lot of criminally minded thinking people?
Justice Stewart, absolutely. But I think the particularly idiosyncratic nature are the use of the screwdriver and the handcuffs readily at hand. I believe those are the things that when taken in conjunction with the, what I'm going to call more, what would be viewed as maybe more common circumstances, right? Maybe somebody's going to have a vehicle to transport an individual away. Perhaps, yes. When a person will most likely do this in an area that is more remote than in the middle of, you know, town square. Yes. But when you take those facts together and then add in the particularly idiosyncratic nature of the handcuffs and the screwdriver, I believe that's what ties this all together as being the particular nature of the facts as showing identity, which was the central issue in this case.
Wouldn't you also compare the hammer and the use of the motorcycle helmet? It seems like it's a reasonable inference the jury could draw.
Oh, absolutely. She was hit in the head with some type of object that was significant enough to cause, in Ms. Gardner's indication, a concussion and skull fracture. And in this case, I believe, if I remember the coroner's testimony, was Ms. Joggin, she had a deep wound on her forehead, which caused significant bleeding, which explains the blood on the outside of the helmet. She had a skull fracture in the left occipital region, which could have been from being hit by a motorcycle helmet, perhaps falling off the bicycle. But there are some similarities in the nature of being struck in the head, as being a mechanism to gain the upper hand before we submit the screwdriver is used to try to gain compliance. So when you look at the facts of this case, with identity being the issue, as this court said in Hartman, which was referenced by Mr. Avellano, as the importance of the factual dispute for which the evidence is offered to the more important that is to the resolution of the case increases, the more probative value a piece of evidence has, and the risk of unfair prejudice decreases. So the state would respectfully submit that in this case, with the defense to the very end denying involvement in the case, their indication that the state's had presented DNA evidence, which is true, and that he put himself at the scene, which is true, it did not prevent the defense from being that Mr. Worley did not commit this crime. So with identity being the central issue, we respectfully submit that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing this 404B evidence, which we submit was, in the idiosyncratic nature of it, textbook 404B evidence. So unless the court has any other questions, I will yield the rest of my time and simply ask that the court deny Mr. Worley's propositions, that Mr. Worley's conviction be affirmed, and that his sentence be allowed to stand.
Thank you. Counsel, as I said, I think we have like 2 minutes and 51 seconds left. You'll have to unmute for us to hear you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. My apologies. The judge said that he wasn't sure if anyone heard what juror number four said. In this case, death is different, and it's most reasonable to assume that the other jurors did hear it. But it wasn't just juror number four; it was a whole host of other jurors and their statements that prejudiced the jury pool. As it relates to Gardner was over the line in Lucas County. It was nearby. It wasn't that far away from this, but also it's important for the defense's closing is not evidence. It's the judge's job to determine what the weight of the evidence presented should be as it relates to the issue in controversy, which is identity. So in Hartman, we've got the court reversed by saying that there wasn't a specific jury instruction that was tailored to the issue, where in that case it wasn't identity. Here it was, but the judge just gave the laundry list, which the court reversed for saying that the laundry list wasn't sufficient. Most importantly now, as it relates to the evidence, there was no evidence that Worley knocked her off of her bicycle in this case. There was evidence that she fell off of her bicycle, yes. This was not in the daytime, it was at dusk. There was no evidence presented in this case that a screwdriver was used to hold the victim at bay.
Counsel.
Yes.
There's no evidence she was knocked off the bike, but there's evidence she fell off the bike?
Reasonable evidence, yes, from the hairline fracture at the back of her skull, yes.
Well, but why fall as opposed to not being knocked off?
In the 1990 case, we have the testimony of Ms. Gardner as to what happened. Here, we don't have any testimony as to what happened, how the victim fell off of her bike.
But her injuries are consistent with someone knocking her off a bicycle.
That's not what the coroner said. The coroner said that the injuries were consistent with someone striking her in the head with a hard object.
Okay.
So how she fell off her bike is an open question. We don't know. And in this instance, Worley was on a motorcycle. That's very important. He used a truck in 1990 to knock the bicycle off the road. In this instance, we don't know if he was even present when she fell off her bike. So again, those are significant differences. But then again, the government almost proves our point. I think they do, from the standpoint of saying, you know, the screwdriver was there. There's a screwdriver in the earlier case. Look at all these similarities. He did it again. The identity was not really an issue at the end of this case, at the end of the state's case. They had the DNA. They had his admission of being at the crime scene.
Then why counsel was defense in closing arguments making the argument that you got the wrong guy here?
That was their decision to go with that argument.
If the evidence was overwhelming, tying him there, from a strategic point of view, it would have been better to admit that fact and focus on mitigation, and then you could have kept out this earlier act. But this seems, under Hartman, this seems exactly the type of evidence that the state should be allowed to use when identity is an issue, as long as it's not overly prejudicial.
I think there's a very good argument to be raised that defense counsel probably should have not made that argument, but ultimately it's not up to the defense counsel. It's up to the judge to weigh whether or not there's a need for this evidence to prove identity. And there was overwhelming evidence that he was there and otherwise involved in the abduction. This was not even close. And these abduction kits that they said were in his trucks, that's not even relevant because Worley was on a motorcycle. So with that, I would like to wrap up if the court has any other questions.
Well, counsel, how did he move her body?
The allegation from the government is that he came back and used a truck to transport the body after the initial contact, and would assume a detainment of the victim.
Okay. All right. Well, hearing no other questions, thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.